Hi, I'm Elaine. Welcome to my podcast channel.
Good evening, Carolyn. How are you?
Good evening. I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm great. I was wondering if you would like to self-introduce about your institution, your background a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. My name is Carolyn Colain, and I'm a mathematics professor at Simon Fraser University. And there I do research on using math to understand infectious diseases. So for the past few years, I've been working quite a lot on the COVID-19 pandemic, using modeling and statistics to understand how it spreads and to build models to use sequence data from the virus, the viral RNA, to better understand how it moves around the world and how it's evolving.
Mm-hmm. That sounds really interesting. So you work with both biology and mathematics. So science, of course, but how do they bridge together or connect, any connections that you find between these two fields?
Yeah, there are lots of connections. So I think we can use mathematical models to simulate processes in the world and see what happens when we change things, see if our understanding is correct. So if we have a guess for what's causing a certain phenomenon and we can develop a simulation model that we can explore, we can check the consequences of our assumptions. So if we assume two viruses are going to compete, what does that mean about what happens when we suppress one of the viruses and not the other one? Or if we assume that, you know, people infect each other at a certain rate, then we see something happen in the data, then what does that mean about the effects of lockdowns or the effects of distancing measures? So we use mathematical models that we use to describe mechanisms in the world, and we explore how the models behave, we compare them to data, and we try to learn about the biological world and the physical world, partly through the lens of those mathematical models.
Yeah, so we started with COVID and we have this Omicron. So how do you think that Omicron even evolved through, how do you think viruses evolve into different varieties? So in a way that we are, it's hard for a lot of scientists and humans to prevent the disease. How do you think it really evolved so fast?
Yeah, so the viruses like SARS-CoV-2, coronaviruses, and many other viruses can actually pick up mutations relatively quickly in their RNA. And those mutations are often not very interesting or not very advantageous for the virus, but sometimes it will come up with a mutation that does something that improves something the virus needs to do. So it might improve how the virus binds to our cells or how the virus gets into our cells. So through the process of generating that diversity, these millions of infections worldwide, all of which have a chance to mutate, there will rarely be some that are just innovations for the virus. So with Omicron in particular, the most likely path seems to have been that it was inside a human host for potentially a long time, like for many months. Mm-hmm. And that long interaction with the human immune system, possibly someone whose immune system was suppressed in some way or compromised, that let the virus keep testing and testing new innovations to see if it hit on something that was really great. And so then it did hit on something, unfortunately for us, that was really great for it. And that led to Omicron's, you know, really high increase in transmissibility.
Yeah, sounds really interesting. So I've also heard from other people, they were saying, there were debates out there that says sometimes when we wear masks, it doesn't really sufficiently protect us from these diseases. Do you think it's true that masks aren't that efficient?
Well, you have to ask, you know, sufficient for what? Closer fitting masks and so on will protect differently. To me, I think even if something isn't perfect, it can still be a good thing to do. So I think it's true that community mask use does not 100% stop all transmission. So yes, there can be gaps in masks. Yes, surgical masks may let things in. Yes, people may not wear their N95s completely perfectly at all times, but reducing those opportunities for transmission can still delay transmission. It can prevent transmission on many occasions, even if it's not perfect. So I think you wouldn't want perfection to be the enemy of the good, right? And you also want to think about, what are you comparing this to? is wearing a mask when you're in a really densely crowded indoor environment that's poorly ventilated
mm-hmm.
perfect? No. Is it a lot better than nothing? Yeah, probably.
Yeah. It still covers up with something, you know.
And it can prevent you, you know, if you're sneezing or if you're infectious, it can prevent you from infecting others, which is valuable to you, you know, because you like the people you're with and we value protecting our communities.
Mm-hmm. So I'm really curious about your day in the life of a math professor at SFU. So could you tell us something about your daily schedule?
Yeah, so I have a combination of online and in-person meetings. Mm-hmm. And I also do thinking sometimes. So reading papers, thinking about them, reviewing them, either papers that we're writing in our group or that colleagues have written or that I'm reviewing for a journal. And I sometimes do my own mathematics too, working out research questions that I'm interested in or making small, you know, hour by hour progress on those questions. Right now I'm not teaching a lot, but the daily life of most mathematicians would involve undergraduate teaching. So maybe 3 lectures a week of a course that we're hopefully interested in. So that's a part of university life for many people, just not for me right at this moment. And then the meetings are with people that are in my research group who are doing research in collaboration with me, graduate students, postdocs, and faculty that I'm working with. Mm-hmm. Or some of the meetings are also with colleagues around the world, colleagues in BC that we're working together, or sometimes with government or other people that we're talking to and advising about COVID or about the topics that we do research on.
Oh, that's great. So you think COVID's getting better, like way better right now compared to before?
That's a good question. So absolutely, you know, we're in a much better position than we were at the start of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
I would say in BC right at this moment, it's not in a pronounced decline. There's a lot of COVID out there. It's probably holding pretty steady. And it's hard to know what exactly is going on just because testing is changing through time and hospital reporting is also changing to some extent through time. So it's a bit hard to get a really clear picture right now of, for example, how many people in Vancouver have COVID right now. Like, we don't probably really know that. We could make some educated guesses. But I think we are in a better position than we were in the first year and a half of the pandemic. And mm-hmm. But it's still here. It's still creating a burden of illness and some severe disease, and also an unknown burden of disability and chronic disease that I think we need to start thinking about.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that health is really, really important. And I love how you connect math and biology together, because I maybe some people would think that there's not much connection between these subjects, but they're actually really, really connected. How you can use math modeling to compute or whatever the viruses. Yeah. And yeah, so I think that is really, really cool. So back to math, what do you think is, according to your personal opinion, what's the most interesting part of the SFU math program, do you think?
Oh, that's a great question. So I of course, as an applied mathematician, I like applied math. So, you know, people, I think researchers and professors will often say that they like the research they do. And that's because they do the science they want to do. So I don't necessarily like something because I do it. I may also do that thing because I like it. So one thing I really like about SFU is the strength that we have in applied math, in bringing math to problems in biology, even in cancer, and fluids and how they flow, in physics, and of course in my work in infectious disease. We have people working on applications in linguistics and in the brain. We've had projects. So I love the applied math focus. I think SFU also has good strengths in discrete math, which is the study of kind of discrete objects like graphs, which have nodes connected by edges, or counting types of discrete structures. And I think that's a nice part of math that not all math departments have. And of course, we have strengths in pure mass, which is mass that's about other mass. And you know, that's also really beautiful and really exciting for people who really like that abstraction and that kind of inherent beauty in seeing like what are the kinds of objects we can think about and define and how do they work and how are they connected at deep levels to each other and to topics in physics and other areas. So I think we have a range of strengths. And of course, my particular focus is really on the applied side.
Yeah, for sure. And do you teach year one students at SFU or mostly the seniors?
So not these days, actually, because of the pandemic really took a lot of my focus and we built two different organizations. And so I haven't been teaching throughout. When I last taught at SFU, I taught a second year operations research course. And that's actually a nice thing about SFU too. Operations research is the task, well, the way it, within math, it's the task of kind of using mathematical models and simulation to help an organization figure out what to do. So you might figure out how to schedule buses in a way that makes the whole schedule more efficient with fewer delays. Or you might try to schedule the buses so that they don't all pile up like three in a row. Although apparently that's very hard to do. They will just generically always pile up. You get several buses at the same time and then a big gap. But I taught a course for second year students about that. And it was really fun because they had projects. And so they came up with data and a question. You know, one was about the SFU gondola and would it really be better and how many more people could it take and the consequences of that on the transport to and from SFU. Another was about where we might want to put mass transport lines in the Fraser Valley. So it's a fun course because it's really accessible for second year. Well, at the second year level, you don't have to be really advanced to take it, but it really brings in some fun applications.
Yeah, sounds really interesting. So do you also teach postdocs or doctoral students as well?
Yeah, so I have undergrad research students and master's students and PhD students and postdocs working in the group right now.
Yeah, so what do you think is the fundamental basic difference teaching like undergrads and postdocs? Are there any differences between these students?
Yeah, absolutely. So of course, postdocs already have their PhD, so they've already done scientific research and published it. Teaching undergraduates is mostly in a lecture format. You go, you give a class three times a week, and the class has an outline, and it has assignments and a midterm and an exam, and then it's done. I think one of the really big differences is when you have a class and an exam, and then it's done, the students hand in their work once, and they get their A or their B or whatever it is, and then the work doesn't get redone. Whereas when you move into doing research, you do a project, and you sort of feel like, okay, I tried all these things and I did this thing. And then you look at it and you have your colleagues or your supervisor look at it. And then you think of all these other things and you think, oh yeah, okay. So now we should do this again and we should do it this way. Or now we should do something else and we should do it that way. And now we should write it again and do it again and do it again. And I think that's a real frame shift, like being used to having your work be done, handed in, get your A, versus done, handed in, oh, now there's a whole bunch of science to do to think about it and learn something about the research question. And then we do this project until we think it's a meaningful contribution and the kind of thing we wanted to say. And we've learned something and then we try to publish it. And then it comes back with these tepid responses from reviewers and then you do it again. And so I think that's a big difference. The lecture format versus the one-on-one, but also just the nature of what is done and how much we see that we have to learn. Once we start doing research, there are just endless worlds of things we don't know, and getting comfortable with that can just be a challenge at that stage for sure.
Totally agree. How about for your undergrads? Do you give them an opportunity to do retests if they don't do that well, or try again, something like that, improvement marks or anything?
That depends on the courses. When we have projects in the courses that I would teach, we would usually, have students be able to submit a draft and then get comments on it. So it wouldn't be like a grade and then a redo. It would be like more like a model of, okay, we're going to start that process of you do the thing once, we think about it, you get some feedback, and then you continue mm-hmm. the project at using that feedback to make it better. So in project-based courses, yes. Generally, you don't get to retake a final exam, for example.
Oh.
Yeah. Same system as in high school, I guess.
Oh, interesting. So are there students at the undergrad level, were they transitioning from grade 12 high school to university, did they have a hard time in a way, or it's basically kind of like the same system and pace as high school, or it's way more rigorous and there's so much workload?
I think it can be a shock. I think the high schools, of course, differ a lot from each other, and so it can be hard for university departments to really understand where students are coming from, since they will all have potentially very different high school experiences, and they'll be in different programs doing different selections of courses, and they'll have different priorities and different interests. So I think it can be a challenge at first for students to kind of get into that university mode, especially when there isn't homework that's due necessarily every week. So then it can be quite easy to put off revising your lectures and then it can be hard to catch up. I think that's one thing students struggle with.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And so for people out there in high school, they want to transition into or specialize in university math or in their future careers, or they want to be, are you a virologist or something, or mathematician studying COVID, what prerequisites do you recommend them taking right now?
That's a great question. I think some science background, for applied math, some science background is really helpful because you're going to apply math to something in the world. So it's good to know about how scientists think about reasoning about those things in the world. What would we expect to see if my idea was true or my hypothesis? What could make it look like that but not be my hypothesis? So I think for applied math, some science is good, as well as math and statistics. The more I've matured as a researcher, the more interested I've become in statistics, partly because, you know, now we have data and then you need to think about statistics. I think it can be taught in a way that is very boring and that students are just very put off by. I know many of us were when I was a student, but actually conceptually, this like thinking rigorously about what the observations we see in the world actually mean is part of statistics, and that's a really interesting task. And I think statistics has a lot of applications, has a lot of math in it, but also, you know, brings you close to data science and some really flexible areas, along with applied math, which, you know, I also like for that flexibility, that idea that once I understand some principles of how to do modeling, I can do modeling that helps me understand how COVID spreads, or I could do modeling that helps me understand blood cell production and regulation, or I could do modeling that helps understand forest fires and what they might do, or I could just think about so many different topics. And so I really like that breadth that we can achieve with applied math.
Yeah, for sure. And do you think there's some theoretical connection between mathematics and nature in general?
Yes, I do. Partly through the processes that are shared. So mm-hmm. if you have, just think about like exponential growth. You can see that when you have one thing that can cause more of itself, like a phenomenon that can be self-reproducing, like rabbits, the classic example of even the Fibonacci series, or just any model of a population where every year, each rabbit has some probability of having baby rabbits, and mm-hmm. they might have two or three or one or zero, but the mean is more than one. You're going to see an exponential rabbit growth. You also see forest fires can seed other fires because fire can spread, and each patch that is on fire might seed another patch. And so in this, you get sort of the same mathematical phenomenon, even though the entities are really different, or bacteria can divide. They're completely different than rabbits, but they share the property that the population can each give rise to new members of it, of the population, mm-hmm. each generation. And so you see that same mathematical phenomenon, even though the entities are really different. There are probably deeper connections that are around the kinds of things we think about when we think about mathematical objects and the kinds of ways we think that, you know, must in some sense be rooted in nature, because we are animals and we are natural beings. And so the way we've learned, the ways we've learned to understand our world are very much informed by nature and are part of nature. So there are these sort of very concrete examples like exponential growth or fractals or other cool things that connect math to nature. But I think there may also be kind of deeper connections in how nature has inspired us and the way we've built mathematics.
Yeah. So do you think, regarding what you said, how we built mathematics, do you think math is human made, or do you think it's always there?
I think some aspects are always there. There are fundamental truths about the universe that couldn't be any other way. But I do think mathematics is shaped by our own interests and tastes, and there are cultural aspects of mathematics. Not that the cultural aspects shape what's true in math or not. That's not what I'm saying. I guess I think that the cultural aspects shape what we think of as beautiful mathematics and what we think of as interesting and what kinds of conjectures we think are worth pursuing, what we want to prove. So there's a lot of mathematics that could be done, and we choose as a field and as a community or a set of communities that are interacting what problems are interesting and what to work on. And those come from mathematics itself and the deep truths that it contains, but they also come to some extent from our tastes for what is beautiful and what is interesting mathematics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so since you work with biology and math, what do you have a recommended book related to biology and math or COVID or something math modeling?
I do have a recommended book. I really like this book. This is by a friend and colleague at UBC, Sally Otto, and Troy Day, who's a mathematician. He's currently the head of math at Queen's. And it's called A Biologist's Guide to Mathematical Modeling in Ecology and Evolution. And it is a great book at the interface of math and biology, because it illustrates a lot of different tools. It's more aimed for, it's called A Biologist's Guide. It's more aimed for biologists. But I think it's also a good read for undergraduate math students and for high school students who are really keen on math already but haven't been exposed that much to modeling and biology. So I like this one. I also like, I don't have it here, I like Anderson and May's Infectious Diseases of Humans. That's a really great book. Obviously it's about infectious diseases of humans, and it's blue, and it's a famous book in the field of infectious disease modeling. And it just shows like how you can use math to model all kinds of different infectious diseases. And it has a lot of background about them. So I like that book too.
Yeah, so do high school students for both books, do they need a certain level of knowledge or just high school math knowledge? And then it's just all about biology.
I think these are more about the math modeling. It's not a lot of like really technical biology, but I think they do need some calculus, and I think probably a little bit of probability, so depending what you're getting from high school. But that said, you know, if you don't have I think these books would give you a lot, even if you don't have all of the math background that you would need to understand every single line, and in a way that's something that you can learn, you know, when you're interested in a topic. You can pick up the things that you don't know independently. And in a way, as researchers, we all have to do that. There's no class that we can teach to learn what we need to learn. And so when we need to learn something we just have to go read it and figure it out and ask our colleagues and friends and learn it independently. So that's definitely something that is a good habit to get into.
Yeah, for sure. It sounds really interesting. So do you think that COVID, I don't know if I can ask this online or share it, whatever. Do you think COVID is government invented, or do you think it's a natural evolution? It's just through time, like we just find these weird things in nature.
Yeah, I think this is a virus that most likely came from an animal population, probably made the jump to humans. It seems very likely that it was not engineered. I don't think anyone created this to be a pandemic virus. You could probably create something worse. And also you wouldn't start with this virus. It's not a good starting point. Mm-hmm. There's been a recent debate about whether this virus might have been studied in a lab before the pandemic started. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to get into that huge debate, but I'll just say I think the most likely, from what I've seen, is that it is from an animal population that made the jump to humans. Mm-hmm. And when viruses make a jump from an old host, in this case probably bats, to a new host, humans, they're living in a new environment and they can get new mutations and new abilities in order to succeed in that new environment. So they can become a bit different from their ancestor as they evolve. And we've seen that in the past years as the virus picked up new transmissibility with Alpha and then with Delta and then again with Omicron picking up immune evasion. So we're seeing that evolution happening over the past few years. So no, it was not invented by governments and it wasn't engineered. And I think we may never know if it ever spent even a minute in a lab somewhere in between the bats and the people.
Yeah.
But right. And so that's very hard to tell.
Because,
is related to coronaviruses that are in other animals and in bats. And there are lots of coronaviruses and they are in lots of different kinds of animals. And I think these pandemics, you know, they're always a risk. Pandemics have been happening throughout the ages and they will always happen. And this one isn't even that unusual. You know, think about it. We could have had a MERS-like coronavirus that, you know, MERS has about a 35% fatality rate. Mm-hmm. We could have had a much worse pandemic virus. The Black Plague was not a virus, but it had about a 50%, I think, mm-hmm. fatality rate. So, I mean, these are epically unfolding disasters. And this one, by comparison, is not so unusual as a virus.
Mm. Yeah. So, I mean, normally for a human being to recover, personally, it only takes me 3 days to recover because I got COVID before. But why do you think the regulations are to isolate for 2 weeks minimum or something?
So I think that's not true in BC right now. Mm-hmm. I think it has changed over time. I'm not sure exactly what it is right now, but I think the requirement to isolate after 5 days was recently lifted. So there isn't a 2 week of isolation rule mm-hmm. right now. The time between infection and not being able to infect others does really vary. For some people, it probably is a few days. For others, it can drag on. And that depends a little bit on how sick you are, but it can also be people who are not very sick can have a high viral load for a long time. So the extent to which you feel ill is not a great predictor for how much virus you have that you might be able to spread to others. So why have the guidelines been what they've been over time? I think perception of the need. So what are the consequences of having different guidelines? Would we have overwhelmed hospitals if we hadn't been controlling COVID in 2021? Yes, we would have. I think that was pretty clear. Now, with most people vaccinated and many people also having had COVID, that sort of acute burden on hospitals has really changed. So that informs how guidelines change too.
Yeah. So over your years in the medical, viral, industry, so you have a lot of, ideas about different viruses happening. So over maybe the future, decades later, what changes in this field do you expect, or will we have new viruses coming up? Do you think there's a potential for that to happen?
Yeah, so absolutely. There's always the potential for new viruses. There's mm-hmm. We have a large human population. We have a changing climate. We have changes in the ways in which we interact with wild animal populations and the ways they interact with each other and the ranges that they have as the climate changes. So I think we will have not only more opportunities, as we would always have had another opportunity for a pandemic throughout the ages, but we may have an increasing number of those opportunities for new viruses to get into people, explore the space right adjacent between wild animals and livestock and domestic animals and people. In the past 20 years, we saw SARS-1, we saw the H1N1 in 2009, the MERS coronavirus, which was from camels, and had a high fatality rate, like I mentioned. There's been Zika virus. There's been outbreaks of Ebola virus. There's been the Mpox or monkeypox recently. That's just in the past 2 decades. That's actually quite a lot. That's probably not all of them. So, I think there will, and of course, relatively recently before that, there was HIV. So I think these will keep happening. And I think we need to think about what we can do to prevent them from becoming pandemics. Another change, you asked sort of changes in that's sort of the viruses in the world, in the field and in research, I think we will get the ability to have better data faster. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking specifically of, technologies that can sequence and identify lots of viruses from the same sample. So imagine instead of having the swab and you do a COVID test, you have a swab and it actually tests for 7 different respiratory viruses. And the ones it finds, it gets a genetic sequence so that you can figure out, where the most likely source of that virus is, or something about how severe it's likely to be. I think that kind of technology is nearby. And I hope that we will, before something comes out of a bat in 2035, also figure out how to share those data and really make the most effective, quick use of them worldwide in a way that can help to prevent pandemics. I think we're not quite there yet with the sharing and the coordination, but I hope that we will get there.
Yeah. So which country do you think has the strongest medical background?
I can't comment on that. But I can say that in terms of the data collection and data sharing, I would say the UK has been really a world leader in getting COVID, getting the samples, getting the sequences, doing the random testing in the population from the Office of National Statistics Survey, learning from those data to figure out, what's Alpha doing in its evolution that is making it the way it is, what's driving the growth of Alpha at the start. They did not have less COVID due to all that. It wasn't that sharing that data and getting it enabled them to have a lower burden of COVID than, say, we did. It may have enabled them to have a lower burden of COVID than they would have if they hadn't had those data. It's hard to know what would have happened if we'd had different policies. So I would say the UK has definitely been a leader in that kind of science, getting the evolution, the epidemiology, the biology, the analysis, the math together. I think they were really a huge leader there, but I can't really say who has a more or less advanced medical system, because I don't really know.
Yeah, but I think Canada has a really strong medical background too. Pretty good great medical services too. But there's tons of viruses out there, and throughout, as time passes, there's always new ones. And do you think maybe one day, using mathematics and technology, do you think we can eliminate all of these potential viruses that's happening? Or why do viruses even exist at the first place? Shouldn't this be a perfect world that we live in?
Yeah, no, I don't think we could eliminate all viruses, and I don't think we would want to, just like we wouldn't want to eliminate all insects. Yeah. They probably play a useful ecological role in the microbial communities and in the ecological communities that we rely on. So I don't think we would be able to eliminate all viruses, and I don't think we would probably really want to. But I think we do seek to eliminate very dangerous viruses. We would seek that with polio. We saw that with smallpox. I don't think we'll eliminate COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 at this point. I think that opportunity was lost, especially since it gets into animal populations. There isn't much of a plausible way that we're, certainly with the policies we have now, that we're looking to eliminate it. But with something like polio, that may be possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, back to math again. Sorry for the switching, but in high school, a lot of people are suffering through mathematics. Some people are really good at it, And do you have any tips for people who are having a hard time with math, even though they spend a lot of time on it themselves, where they sometimes they still don't do as well on their tests and stuff? So any tips for that?
Yeah, so one challenge I used to see when I was tutoring high school was that people would sometimes have kind of been pattern matching, so they could solve the problems by like repeating the operations that they'd seen before, but there was something they had missed, like even just the meaning of like, what does the line between two numbers, if you have A over B, like what does that line actually mean? And they'd been kind of able to answer questions enough to do okay on tests, but there was some fundamental point they had missed. And actually, once that got fixed, there was sort of an oh moment of realization of like, oh, that's what that means. And that's where it becomes, you know, possible to answer new questions that don't look like the questions you answered before, because you actually understand something and now you can apply it to a new framework. So although it sounds maybe time consuming, if there is something like that, if there's something that you've missed early on, like what the fraction really means or what the X means in your algebra equations, I think it's good to try to take a step back and catch up on one on those sort of key concepts that might be missing, because the rest can fall into place. Whereas if you keep trying to sort of guess and match the patterns of, okay, so when I see N, I need to do this, and when I see X, I need to do that, like that's where I think it can actually make it much harder for people if they're trying to kind of match the pattern and repeat the steps without necessarily understanding some basic point.
Yeah, I think a lot of misconception about math is patterns and stuff, even though it's true that math has a lot of tons of patterns to follow, but some patterns it might not even make sense. And I think of what you mentioned, you have to understand why that happens.
Yeah, so asking why, not just what to do to solve the question. And I think sometimes it can be really hard, you know, even now at every level, it's really hard to force ourselves to focus on the part we don't understand. It's quite easy to kind of enjoy sitting with the part we do understand. But that, you know, teaching your brain to say, wait, this part here, this part I don't actually fully understand, that can save, it sounds time consuming, but I think it can save so much time because it builds a foundation that is strong that then you can build more on top of.
Yeah, for sure. And I really like your tips, I think. Especially people who are really, really good at math, they sometimes just, they don't have time for reading math books. I think some mathematically talented people, they focus a lot on competition questions, and it's also about like tactics or whatever things happen like that too.
Right.
Yeah. But to end off, another last question. So you work on mathematics and different coronaviruses. What additional hobbies do you have that supplements your studies or that would help you to improve? You know, there's always like people have a hobby that really helps them a lot.
Yeah, so I do music. I sing in a small chamber choir and I play the piano and I go running and I go kayaking. Those are my main hobbies. And I have kids, so I do parenting.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, but thank you so much for answering my questions.
Absolutely. I enjoyed talking with you. It was great. A great discussion. Thank you so much.